latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Amazing achievements for Pennsylvania breeds on the world stage. Thanks to Finest City, Unique Bella, and Shamrock Rose, PA joins Kentucky as the only state in the past decade to breed Eclipse Award champions three straight years. Add that to our unmatched incentives. Plus, our racehorse development fund can only be used to support PA breeding and racing. Why breed anywhere else? This is Brian Sanfratello. Go to PABred.com and see why Pennsylvania is the premier place to breed and race.
Horsebills.com is a cost-effective, time-saving, paperless revolution. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for owners and other vendors who can pay through Horsebills.com for just 50 cents. Turn hours of work into minutes with our easy-to-use site. Have our team take over your bookkeeping or continue to do it yourself and pay only our low monthly subscription fee. Check out our video tutorial on the Horsebills.com YouTube channel and get started today for free. Horsebills.com. Toll-free number 888-938-4643.
Learn the business of horses in the world's only accredited equine business program, the University of Louisville Equine Business Program. The University of Louisville has a legacy of excellence for more than 25 years of equine business education. Classes are taught by industry experts in state-of-the-art facilities located in the heartland of America's equine industry. The University of Louisville Equine Business Program. When it comes to horses, we mean business. For more information, visit business.louisville.edu/equine.
Why is accreditation important in aftercare? The Thoroughbred Aftercare Alliance's standard of accreditation and grant process provide donors with confidence that their contributions are allocated in the most effective manner. TAA accreditation is only awarded after a complete review of an organization. Aftercare cannot be an afterthought for the industry. To learn more or support the TAA's mission, visit thoroughbredaftercare.org.
Hey, what's going on? Mikey here, and I'm going to tell you about an offer from my good friends at ExpressBet. Let's be honest. We know you love playing the races, but you can't always make it to the track. Sometimes life just gets in the way of a good bet. Well, what if I told you about a place where you never miss a bet and you start with house money? You'd say I'm crazy, right? Well, not at ExpressBet. Your first $100 are on them. That's right. Sign up at ExpressBet.com using promo code XBRadio, bet $100, and they'll deposit $100 back into your account the very next day. Hey, plus you could get an extra $25 if you use Express Fund Direct Deposit. You see what I mean? House money for betting the races. It's that easy. Check it out at ExpressBet.com to learn more. And don't forget to sign up for promo code XBRadio. You're gonna love it. And that's a Mikey guarantee. Must be 18 years or older and 21 years old in certain states to open an account with ExpressBet and reside in a state where such activity is legal. Void or prohibited. National Gambling Support Line 800-522-4700.
Now, back to At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Jackpot, which we have not heard in ages. Good job, Joe. As speaking of jackpots, as Sid Fernando described to you yesterday, how about the Brazilian farm, the Haras, whatever it was, that ended up with their hands on New Year's Day? They hit the jackpot because maximum security enabling them to sell New Year's Day to Japan for $5 billion. And Steve Haskin, good morning.
Good morning.
That was. Did you hear Sid yesterday? That story.
I didn't. I heard the. I heard him in the beginning, and then I had to leave.
Well, all right.
I had to leave. I had to leave because of you.
Where did you go?
To get a new phone.
Nice. I'm so proud of you.
Don't be proud of me. I want my old phone back. This phone, I feel like I'm lifting barbells holding this up to my ear.
It sounds good, though. I'll tell you that. You're clear as a bell.
Well, I wish the phone was clear. Every time I put it on, the screen is so dark, and then it gets light when it wants to, and it gets dark again. I don't know. Who knows?
Well,
you know, I don't like change. I like what I have. My own little phone. I could hold it up to my ear. I could even let go of it. This thing is like so big. I said, what kind of phone is this? This is like holding a computer up. I need a second phone to hold up to my other ear so I can at least balance myself.
Well, does it have all the bells and whistles? Can we send you photos and all
who
kinds
knows?
Of things?
I don't know. Who knows? I'm like my wife. She's got a new iPhone. You know what she does with it? She makes calls and gets tagged. That's it. I mean, I don't think she's looked at an app yet. And
what about?
You know, I've got all these apps. I might use one for a GPS or something, but all the other stuff, I don't need all that. You know? I'm still back in the ages of the phone booths.
You know, and the rotary Superman.
Phone. By the way, they had a thing online where they had like it was like high school or college students. They had like a whole bunch of them, and they gave them the old rotary phones. And they asked him to make a phone call, and they had absolutely no clue how to dial a rotary phone. No clue. It was like this weird contraption from the medieval days. They had no clue what to do.
Well, there's also that series. On YouTube. There's a series of videos where kids, teens, and younger kids are shown various implements of history. And there's one, the one I saw most recently was a record player. And the kids looked at, a few of them knew right away. They said, that's a record player. This is, wow, this is a record player. And they, but there was a couple of younger kids that were maybe seven, eight, 9 years old that just stared blankly and had no clue what they were looking at.
See, I'll go one better, by the way. I'll guarantee you, you look at the millenniums, you look at the teenagers now and the young kids, I'll bet they wouldn't have a clue what a VCR is.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's true.
You know? I mean, it's just, you know, the whole world has just gone way beyond my reach. I'm getting older by the. You remember the Bob Dylan song "Forever Young"? That's me inside, but not outside.
Yeah, well, that's true. You are young at heart, and
I am young at heart. I'm just not young in hand. Yeah, give me something. I don't know what to do with it. I don't know. I have no clue what to do with this phone. The thing is, I looked at it. I barely know how to answer it. You know, when Joe called before. Yeah, I look at my phone. I says, the guy in the store says, "That's just exactly like your old phone, except a few little things." Or, no, it's not.
Well,
my old phone is a lot easier.
You can take pictures. You can take pictures of Theo. Isn't that the most
important
thing?
Yeah, but I got a camera for that. I don't want to take it on here because if I take it on here, then it's on here. If I take it with my camera, then it's got a chip, so I can put it in my computer, and then I send it out to my photo store, and I get prints.
Whoa, I'm an old print guy.
I don't want pictures on my phone. I want pictures that I can hold in my hand in a photo album. Again, like an old fogey. Remember, you know, people, photo album? What the heck's a photo album? What, are you kidding? A photo album? The thing is, I have all these photo albums. I go to my photo store now. They don't even sell them anymore. They don't even sell photo. You can't even get my photo albums. I got to use old ones and I got like 8,000 piles of photographs all over the house, in envelopes and everything. You know, but everybody's got like 9,000 photos on their phone. You know, I don't, I don't, I don't want my photos on my phone. I want something I can hold in my hand.
Well, speaking of throwback, earlier this morning, I don't know if you had a chance to listen. You could listen on your phone, though. You know, the conversation I had with Bill Gallo about today's Smithwick, but
yes, when I was
home with my father on Sunday afternoon, when things went sideways, I said to Tina, because my brother was going up to Manchester, I said, let's go join Jamie and we'll spend the afternoon with my father.
I just want to say, by the way, I was looking forward to you being at the 1863 club, by the way, so I'm very disappointed that you're not there.
I'm sorry. I did not give Pat McKenna enough notice. I only checked in with him yesterday, and they had some function, so it wasn't a good day. But next week for Whitney, the build-up to Whitney Day. And by the way, while I have you, that's another thing I got to talk to you about, of course, is Mary Lou. But that conversation I had with Bill at the end about his father and his father's artwork in the Daily News.
Right.
And you've got to have an appreciation for that.
Oh, God, are you kidding?
Of sports cartoons.
That was the best thing in the paper.
Yeah.
They were the greatest, absolutely the greatest. And you know where he did most of his sketches was in Gene Ward's column. Gene Ward was strictly a columnist for the news. And Gene Ward was a big racing fan. In fact, it was Gene Ward, John Nehru will tell the story. It was Gene Ward that put all the pressure on John Nehru to run Dr. Fager in the Kentucky Derby. And Nehru got so sick of him already, you know, for him coming out and saying Dr. Fager should run in the Kentucky Derby, and McKnight was saying, you know, what's with this guy? You know, maybe we should run in the Derby? And Nehru said, no, just don't listen to this guy, you know. And no, he's not running in the Derby. He's not running in the Prix. He wound up running in the Withers, you know, at a mile. So I mean, you know, Nehru knew his horse and he knew he wasn't ready. But Gene Ward kept, you know, he was the one that we kept plugging away. But Bill, every one of his columns, they would have like a different. It wasn't like one column on one subject. So he would write about something, and then he would write about something else, and then something else. So he'd have like maybe three or four different items in his column, and each one was divided by a Bill Gallo sketch, and they were great. I mean, when I think of the Daily News, I think of Bill Gallo. You know, you think of Dick Young, you know, writing sports, and again, when I became a racing fan, I think of Gene Ward. Jim McCulley was covered the races, but Gene Ward wrote the column. But those Bill Gallo sketches in Gene Ward's column were classics. I wish I had. Actually, I have some of them in my Arts and Letters scrapbook because I have Gene Ward was writing columns about Arts and Letters a lot, so. I do have some of those Bill Gallo sketches, but he was really, really good.
That's a bygone era, really. The sports cartoonist, the sports editorial cartoonist.
Yeah, and this is pre-Peb.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
You know? I mean, he was writing the. You know, I mean, you know, Peb was doing political cartoons, and then started coming in. Peb was just starting doing, you know. Racing cartoons. He was there, but it was a different type of thing. You know, he'd have his equine comedy, and yeah, I mean, you know, Pep was an absolute genius. But yeah, Bill Gallo was different. He didn't try to be like funny. He just tried to make caricatures of people and horses, and then he would do his sketches of the Mets. Yeah, and the bums. He was big on the Brooklyn Bums. You know, the Brooklyn Dodgers. The bums.
Sure.
He would always have that. You know, that bum. That's cartoon of the bum. He was. He was the best.
I'm going to give everybody the link to that book that Bill asked. I knew there was a compilation. It's called Drawing a Crowd. I'm going to send a link out to it, and I think we've. It might be early yet, but I'm pretty sure somebody, a Mets fan is that has a Philly for next year, is going to name her Basement Bertha.
Basement Bertha was great. Yeah, that was one of his best. I mean, Basement Bertha was, Yeah, just to come up with that. That was just the. And the funny thing is that after the Mets won the World Series, you know, how could you, you know, you can't. But it was like, yeah, it was like when JFK died and Vaughn Meader went into obscurity, you know, because he made a whole living imitating JFK. So here, you know, Basement Bertha, yeah, how could you talk about Basement Bertha anymore after the Mets win the World Series?
Well, you have to turn her into penthouse Pamela, or this,
right.
some equivalent. Let me also before we talk about what went on at Monmouth and what's going to happen Friday, Saturday at Saratoga, Steve, with the 3-year-olds, Mary Lou Whitney, and over the years you must have had obviously some brushes with greatness when it came to Mary Lou.
Well, yeah, I wrote a whole column on it. Right after she died last week, so I told all my experiences with Mary Lou in the column, and she was just an absolute wonderful lady. The funny thing is, my first experience with Mary Lou, I didn't know her. I knew of her obviously, and I knew her reputation. I knew of her as a socialite, and it was when Joe Hirsch, had given up covering the Derby and had me take over. And Joe had a regular feature he did every Saturday. He did a socialite column where he would go to Millionaire's Row, and it was always on the Saturday, on Derby Day. So he would write it on Friday and it would be printed on Saturday. And he would go around talking to, you know, all the celebrities and the millionaires, and then just basically saying who was there, so-and-so was spotted, and, you know, and he would maybe get a quote from them, and I didn't want to do that. I wasn't into celebrities at all, but when I started it, this was in 1994, Joe took me around to Millionaire's Row and just showed me what to do, showed me the ropes, showed me where to go, showed me where to find all the celebrities. So we go up there, and he, you know, Mary Lou sees him. And, you know, at the time, you know, Joe would hold court, and, you know, everybody would just fawn all over Joe. And Mary Lou just ran up to him and just said, "Oh, Joe, nice to see you." And, you know, Joe introduced me to Mary Lou, and she paid absolutely no attention to me at all. And, you know, I found it kind of humorous, and I said, you know what, I'm going to go with it in the column. So I wrote, In that first column, I wrote that Joe took me around and introduced me to Mary Lou Whitney, and it was the equivalent of Joe introducing his pet hamster. It was like I wrote that you know about her, and you know as the years went on. You know, I got to realize all the things that she did and what a great lady she was. And, you know, it was, by the way, that column, can you imagine me doing a socialite column to show you how low I stooped, by the way, when I was up there looking for celebrities? I saw Jimmy, this is right during the Dallas Cowboys dynasty, right? This is 1994, right? When they, were winning their Super Bowls. So I see Jimmy Johnson. So I said, I got to get a call, but I don't want, you know, I don't know what to do. And Jimmy Johnson goes into the men's room. So I follow him into the men's room. We're standing side by side at the urinals. I said, so Jimmy, is this your first trip to Churchill Downs? How do you like the Derby? And, you know, he doesn't know who he was talking to. And I'm getting quotes from him standing at the urinal next to him. That's when I realized, I said, I'm not made for this. This is not my kind of thing. And
no.
You know, no, it was not my speed. But the main thing with Mary Lou, by the way, is that where I really got to see how classy she was after that Bert Stone's Belmont.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's easy to say that, oh, someone was sad. No, she was visually, because I was down there on the track with her and John, and she was visually upset. She was almost near tears. And I remember, and this in my column, I quoted her. In fact, I'll read you the quote. She says, "I feel so awful for Smarty Jones." You know, she's standing on the track waiting for the comeback. Mm-hmm. She just won the Belmont. And she said, "We were hoping we'd be second." She says, "I love Smarty. He's done more for racing than any horse I've ever known. And I apologize to everyone for beating him." And she wasn't just saying this. I said, "Wait a second. There is no owner in the country that would say something like that after winning a classic race." And you got to remember is that it had been like 51 years, you know, in between classic victories for Sonny, who had won, you know, the Belmont Stakes, you know, in like 51. So whatever years that is. So, you know, you would think that, you know, now she wins, you know, Sonny had won two Belmonts, the only two classics he ever won. And she was, I'm getting distracted here by my wife who can't get out our back door. The door is stuck and she's pulling on the door here. So, I'm getting a bit distracted. So she can't get out. She's stuck in the house. She's locked in the house. She can't get out in the back, and I can't help her. So you know, this, you know, it's nothing like live radio. She's pulling on the door, she can't open the door. So go upstairs and read for a while, and I'll help you when I get off the. anyway, so where was I? Oh yeah, so Mary, so Mary Lou. I mean. So you would think that she would be happy. And then I went over to John, and I said, "John, I said, you know, you won the Belmont, and congratulations." And John says, "Oh, no, 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 this is bad. Trust me, this is bad." And I said, "Wow, I mean, you don't see anything like that." And then we were at the Travers, and, of course, everybody knows about the biblical storm that came right after the race. I mean, the sky had turned not even black, it turned like purple. I mean, it was like this weird thing. You knew something monstrous was coming in. And then Birdstone wins the Travers, and Mary Lou comes out on the racetrack. And then as the horse is coming back, I mean, the skies opened up, I mean, with these cascades of rain just coming down in waves. And this time, it was almost like redemption. And Mary Lou comes out, you know, on the racetrack, and she is absolutely drenched.
Yep.
I mean, her clothes are clinging to her body. And that's how hard it was raining, when with the lightning and the thunder. And she felt, and she had the sense of the ethereal, you know, like there was something divine about this victory. And I remember she said to me, she says, "I think the gods came out and did this, all this lightning and thunder to congratulate him." She said, "This is just a dream come true." You know, and then one of the greatest things ever is when and you got to remember, by the way, it is raining so hard that I didn't even want to stand out there because I had a video camera with me and I had it tucked under my sport jacket because I didn't want it to get wet. And I said, "I don't know whether to stay out here or not," because it was really pouring, you know, just hitting you so hard in the face. And Mary Lou grasped hold of Nick Cito's hand and with John and all the barn help, and they're standing out on the racetrack singing in the rain. It was like this wild scene. And then, you know, Mary Lou, I remember what she said to me, and I'll read you her quote again. She goes, "Smarty Jones made people all over the country love and cheer for a horse. So then when we beat him, I felt awful." She says, "This time I feel wonderful, and I know now that Birdstone did deserve to win the Belmont." I thought that was a great, you know, she felt redeemed because she thought, you know, that was, you know, she had beaten Smarty Jones by some fluke. But now that Birdstone comes back, and sure, he hadn't run in between.
That's right.
You know, Nick never gave him a prep. He never ran in between. He went from the Belmont right to the Travers. So, I mean, it was just a great scene. And then I had met her and John after that. I actually met them. We had a long conversation. I actually met them in the parking lot of Stewart's. They had pulled into Stewart's when we had a long conversation. But you know, it was after that that I came to realize, you know, just what a wonderful woman she is, and a warm woman, and realize, you know, all she had done for Saratoga, you know, just basically take it out of, bring it out of the ashes and build it back up again with the Museum of Dance and SPAC and everything she did for the town. And you look at it now, I mean, it's just, I've never seen a town grow like Saratoga. But, and the thing is, you know, listen, I covered the Whitney every year. I can't even imagine the Whitney this year with somebody else presenting the trophy. I think many of the people who won the Whitney, it wasn't even so much winning the Whitney, it was to being, having Mary Lou present them the trophy. And then after the race, I would always go back in that little trustees room, you know, off the, you know, the red door that's there that nobody knows what that door is. It's right behind all the, you know, all the tables and chairs on the patio. And Mary Lou would always be there. She'd always sit at the table there, and everybody would be in there having champagne, and they had, you know, little spread out there, and they would show the race over and over again. That's where I always got my best quotes. And for all the races in Saratoga, I'd go back there and talk to the owners, and they'd be watching it. And I'd find all these stories. But everybody would go to Mary Lou, and she'd sit down in the first table over there, and she was just always so happy for the winners. And, you know, and I would talk to her a little bit, and she was just. And I think the best thing that ever happened to her was John. You know, I remember when John, you know, when they got married, you know, it was everybody in their usual skeptical selves said, "Oh yeah, one of those." But boy, were they great together. I mean, John is just a great guy himself, and he's done so much. But they were so good together, and it was so good for each other. It's a great loss. 93 years old, and I was shocked. I said, "Wow, wait a second, Mary." When I heard about it, I said, "Mary Lou Whitney died? That can't be. Mary Lou Whitney's not supposed to die."
No, I know. It literally, I saw somebody. I forget who it was. That it might have been Susie Rasher. Somebody wrote a note and said, "This is one of those people that you just couldn't envision, and not, you know, ever expiring." And you know, my response, it's one of those tough things where you have to say something, and you know, you don't want to be trite. And I just said, "She'll never be gone." She'll live on forever. I mean, she's one of those kinds of presence.
I try to put it all in perspective about, you know, a bygone era, you know, which it is. If you get a chance, read my column. It's right up there.
I haven't had a chance on
the Blood Horse. I try to put it in perspective of what this means, you know, to the history of racing. And what a bygone era. And it's just, there's nobody like that left. The closest one that would left would be, you know, Charlotte Weber. But, you know, I mean, Mary Lou goes back even to another era before Charlotte. You just think back at all those. I remember meeting C.B. Whitney when first time I was ever at Saratoga in the 60s. I just went over and asked him. I just started talking to him about one of his fillies. She was like a grade 3 type filly. There was no grades back then, but she was a nice filly. I can't remember who it was. And he was so gracious, and he was a really nice man, just like Alfred Vanderbilt. You know, you look at these people, and, you know, Alfred Vanderbilt would stand out there every morning by the track giving everybody cookies. But, I missed that aspect of the game when you had these real sportsmen, and they basically rule the sport, but they knew how to win. But more importantly, they knew how to lose. If they lost, no big deal. Come back next time. There was no worries about stud fees, anything like that. All these horses were homebreds, so all these owners knew their horses. None of these horses ever got syndicated until after they were retired. It was very rare. You know, Secretariat was obviously for. Those, you know, reasons where, you know, the stable was had been falling apart, and Christopher Chenery had died, and they needed to syndicate him. But it was a different era. It was a totally different era. Not to say that this isn't a good era. I mean, it's got its, but I mean, the bygone era, it was different. It was you have to be there to see it. You know, now everybody watches races on their cell phones. Back then, I know it sounds crazy to young people, but if you weren't at the racetrack, you didn't see the races. I mean, if you were in New York, you know, New York would televise the races on WPIX, sometimes on WOR at some point. But, you know, you could watch the races on a Saturday, and you could watch the Triple Crown. But, you know, most of, you know, you don't have like what you have now with Saratoga Live, where you can watch, now you can watch the whole card.
Yep. No, it's a different, it's a whole, and it's a boon, obviously, for players. Steve, let me get you to shift gears into sophomore mode, and let's talk about last Saturday and the delayed running of the Haskell. Turned out all right, and obviously a little controversial again. This horse can't run without provoking controversy, and then let's morph into a Curlin and Jim Dandy.
There was no way, you know. When the inquiry sign went up, the first thing that came into my mind was Shakespearean, which is my latest column that's up there now, writing about that race. With the whole column is filled with Shakespeare quotes to fit the whole story of Maxim Security. But the thing with Luis Saez is that when he was riding in Florida, you know, he did have, you know, a reputation of, just being, you know, borderline on there. And, you know, he's an aggressive rider. I mean, there are a lot of riders that are aggressive. And, you know, you really couldn't tell on the angle, certainly not enough to disqualify the horse. But, he looked like he crowded him in there. But King for a Day was a beaten horse already. And there's no room. It was, it's a very fine line between race riding and doing something, that you're not supposed to do. He rides that line. So, it was a combination of race riding and trying to, close off the inside, which is, I apologize for going to the old days, but, in the old days, if you came through on a rider, that rider be blasted. The riders never let anybody come through on the inside. Go try and come through on Eddie Arcaro. He literally would put you over the... Actually, he did. Somebody came through on the inside of him, and he put him over the rail, and he got suspended for a year. He got suspended because he had threatened to do it. It shows you how also the sport had changed. Maxim Security, I think the result was great. By the way, did you stick it out? Were you there?
No.
I didn't think so.
That was ridiculous. In fact, even before it became official, you could see what was, it was like a slow moving train. I mean, you could see what was happening. And as soon as the word came, had the opportunity to go spend the day with my father, and that's what we did.
Good. The first thing I thought of, by the way, I said, boy, there's going to be a lot of canceled dinner reservations. I mean, people who have 7:30 dinner reservations, something like that, and this race is not even going off until almost 8:30. So, I mean, you're going to change your dinner reservation to 9 o'clock or so, or whatever. So, obviously, it was a change of plans, but, it was just one of those crazy things. It turned out well. I mean, the races went off fine, but they were under pressure. They didn't do it because they wanted to. They had too much pressure. The governor was in on the meetings, and all the higher ups, and all the protesters, and that's the world we live in now. These morons standing out there. And they basically dictated this, and all the pressure that the sport is under right now, that they had to figure something out, something to do, even though the first two races went off fine. I think one horse had tied up in the paddock or so.
Maybe with the scratching. Delay, yeah, with the delay.
Yeah. But listen, I don't know. You know, it was brutally hot. But I remember, like, I texted you.
You texted me during the conversation with Dennis.
Yeah. Well, when I covered the 49ers seeking the gold, the temperature was 100 degrees. And I remember at 12 o'clock, and Peb had a amateur riders race that day to start off, you know, before the first race. So I watched that race, and this is like at, you know, 11:30 in the morning or something like that before the first race. And I remember walking from the rail back into the grandstand, and the top of my head was burning. That's how hot it was. It literally was burning. This is when I didn't wear hats, when I actually had hair and I had exposed head, and my head was absolutely burning. It was so hot. And but I remember by like 12 o'clock it was like 99 and went up over 100. And then 49er and seeking the gold got into the most incredible stretch duel I've ever seen. I mean, it was just gut-wrenching. Stretch duel from like the 5/16th pole to the wire. And, yeah, I mean, you know, it happens. I mean, yeah, maybe after the race, they, you know, they hosed them all down. And I went back to the barn where, you know, Woody Stevens was back there with 49er. And 49er had like three fans going on him at the time. And Seton, I went over to Seeking the Gold, who was in the next barn. He was being, you know, hosed down. Yeah, I mean, the horses don't like it, but, you know, it was one of those things. They ran the race. I mean, there was never, ever any thought of postponing it or canceling it or anything. It's just something you don't want to see, but it's there. But under the times we live in now, Mama did what they had to do. And they got a great race out of it. So, you know, obviously it was much cooler then. It was, you know, it was getting dark. But listen, I loved the result. I mean, I thought Maximum Security, racing needed the three-year-old crop and the sport needed him to do that. I mean, we needed somebody, especially in front of his hometown crowd. You know, everybody on the Jersey Shore, I mean, they love this horse. You know, they love him obviously because of what happened in the Derby. You know, which started off the whole Shakespearean aspect to this, but you know, to get disqualified and everything that went along with it, you know, with all the lawsuits and everything and all the craziness. But you know, everybody, and then he comes back and he gets beat in the prep race. But to me, there was nothing to that race. I mean, he stumbled coming from the start. He desperately needed the race, and you know, I thought he ran a good race. He just got beat. King for a Day ran an excellent race. So it was great to see. And I thought he was beat. I thought Mucho Gusto had him beat. He looked like he had the momentum, and that was it. Baffert was going to have his ninth Haskell. And to see Maximum Security dig in was very gratifying. It really was. I think it was a combination of, you know, him fighting off Mucho Gusto and Mucho Gusto probably not wanting that last 16th of a mile. Because you remember, you know, the worst race he's run in his career was at a mile. It was his only race at a mile and eighth. You know, he's excelled at 7 furlongs, a mile and a 16th. But you know, when he ran the Sunderland Derby at a mile and eighth, he went to the front and he stopped, but he tired pretty noticeably and got beat 6 lengths in the race. But so I don't know if he wanted that. But you know, they went 147-2. That's only 3/5 off the track record. So I mean, you can't run much faster. I mean, I thought it was a terrific race and good for Maximum Security. I'm actually surprised. I'm not surprised they're up to they went up to Saratoga and, you know, thinking about the Travers. But I got to tell you, I would be kind of surprised. I'm not saying if it's right or wrong, but I would be kind of surprised if they ran him in the Travers.
Mm-hmm.
Only because they got Game Winner in there, who I think is right now, maybe, I don't know, we'll see what happens in the Jim Dandy, but right now, to me, Game Winner is the horse to beat, going 1.25 miles. So do you really want to have both your top horses when you got, you know, rest them up for the Pennsylvania Derby?
They're a potent 1-2 punch because at the very least, if there's other pace on, maximum security helps set things up for game winner. So why not? Why wouldn't you? I mean,
sacrifice maximum security.
You don't have to sacrifice him. You don't have to necessarily sacrifice him, but you know, especially the way he didn't demand the lead on Saturday by any means.
No, he didn't demand it. He didn't even get it.
No, I mean, he was just set up shop. I thought that, you know, that's an aspect that, you know, hasn't even been really discussed in all the concern about the, you know, about having to go up to the steward stand. The fact that he was three wide for the majority of the race, I mean, for a good five and a half, six furlongs, really enters into the equation. I thought it was a very, very good performance. And you know,
I'm not saying he can't win the Travers. He can certainly win the Travers. But do you really, when you have two horses like that, do you want one of them to get beat? That's the whole thing. When you can try and win with one and then win the Derby with the other.
Nah, I think when you've got two horses, either of which could end up a champion if things break their way, I think you got to play all your cards. And you know, if game winner wins, he wins, and then Pennsylvania Derby, we'll see, and Breeders' Cup Classic. I mean, the 3-year-old championship means something at this point. And I mean, by all rights, I mean, who right now, if you have to vote today, who's your 3-year-old champion?
Well, maximum security.
Yeah, I don't think anybody would argue, except the people that irrationally seem to just spew venom at this collection of owner, trainer, jock, and horse. I cannot recall such a disgusting display as what goes on constantly. You don't have to love the horse and love the people involved, but the way the characterizations are just, they're pitiful.
I would like those people, if they owned horses and they lost the Derby the way Gary West did, if they wouldn't do everything possible because of not so much that he wants the purse or anything, but this is your lifelong dream.
You
get yanked away from him. You want, and you got animosity. And you want to do everything you can. You want to try and get that victory. I mean, even though, you know, it would be satisfying if they did. But
I don't think so.
I'm not going to condemn
him
for what he's doing.
Nah, you can't. I feel differently about that part, but
I'm not saying I agree with it, but I can understand the way he feels.
We understand the way you feel. You compartmentalize it and move on to a degree, but that's not.
Well, like I said, I'm not saying I agree with it, but I understand it. It's two different things. I can't put myself in his shoes, but you know what I mean, because I don't know.
No, I get it.
I don't know what it feels like under those circumstances.
Steve, let's shift out from the Haskell result. Let's quickly talk about the Curlin and the Jim Dandy Friday and Saturday.
Yeah, well, obviously the Curlin, you know, took a few horses away from the Jim Dandy, you know, which is fine. I think the horses running in the Curlin deserve to run in the Curlin more than the Jim Dandy. And I think these are horses that are just up-and-coming horses. And, listen, we can, you know, Curlin has produced a Travers winner, so there's no reason to think that can't find one coming out of here. You never know. We don't know. You know, for a while there, we didn't know what Chad Brown was going to do, you know, because he had two horses, you know, looking at Bikinis, who was a horse that he's been high on for a long time, and highest honors. So for a while, it looked like he might run looking at bikinis in the Jim Dandy and run highest honors in the Curlin.
Right.
But he did the wise thing. I mean, you know, it's asking a lot to beat the horses that are in the Jim Dandy. So, you know, both those horses have only two starts in their life. Looking at Bikinis was extremely impressive last time winning an allowance race. I thought he ran a tremendous race. And I know Chad Brown's been high on him from from day one. And we really don't know how good Highest Honors is. I mean, he looks like a really nice horse in the making, but I don't know what he beat last time. He was 1-5. So, you know, this is the spot to see what you have. You know, Pletcher obviously is giving Intrepid Heart another shot. You know, Belmont might have just been too much too soon. It was only his fourth career start. You know, he didn't get embarrassed in the race, so we'll see what happens when he comes back. And, you know, horses like, you know, Grump's Little Tots, you know, we'll find out. I don't know how good he is. I mean, his last race was okay. But the horse that intrigues me in here is Endorsed. You know, this is a horse that I was very impressed. You know, he went against a real huge speed bias when he ran down a really nice horse in his career debut, and it looked like he had no shot in the race. And he really came and got him, and I thought it was a tremendous race. And then they rushed him right into the Champagne. He ran poorly, and he hadn't run since. And they brought him back in an allowance race in June, and he goes 6 furlongs and 108.3. So now the question is, can he go from 6 furlongs to 1 1/8? If he can, then you've got a legitimate Travers horse on your hands. You know, you got a Son of Medaglia d'Oro out of a Tappet mare. We really don't know how good he is. So, you know, he's going to get played. You know, it's also a good spot for Direct Order. He's coming off a third in that Pegasus behind for a day and Maximum Security, and he finished 6 lengths ahead of the fourth horse in the race. So, you know, he's a consistent horse. He's got a lot of experience, a lot of bottom under him. So we'll see what he does. You know, and then you got, like, you know, Cairo Cat is making his first start of the year, so he's a total question mark. So, you know, I find it an interesting race, and we'll see what comes out of it. We'll see who moves forward and who looks like they can make that next step to the Travers. And as far as the Jim Dandy, you know, it's only 6 horses, but you got some really good horses in here. And I find it going to be a very intriguing race as far as strategy goes, because there's nobody in this race that's ever been on a lead. I mean, the closest horse who's ever been on the lead was War of Will back when he was a grass horse, you know, early in his career. And now, you know, and that was back on the grass, but he doesn't want the lead. Global Campaign likes to be right off the pace. Tax likes to be right off the pace. So the way I look at it now is that I ran a tease on Tax and Luis Saez on Global Campaign. They're going to break on top. You know, they're coming out of post 2 and 4. So, and I think they're both going to be looking at each other. And I see a slow pace here, because they're going to be looking and say, all right, if you want it, take it. All right, and if you want it, take it. And they'll be looking at each other, and probably neither one of them is going to want the lead. So whoever does get the lead will be tracked by the other one, and they'll be going really slow. War of Will are going to be sitting right behind them in third. And then you can have Tacitus and Mijos together behind them, and Laughing Fox will be the trailer. And I, you know, I see a slow pace, and I think it's going to turn into a sprint at the end. And, you know, again, who's the best horse in here? I don't know. You know, Global Campaign, I don't think we've seen by far the best of him. He looks like a horse who's definitely on the improve. You know, tax. We know what we get from him, but it's all going to be between Tacitus and War of Will. If you want to start looking at Thoroughgraph, Tacitus is by far and away the fastest horse in the race. You know, he had run the 3/4 in the wood, and then paired up at ones. And nobody's as fast as him. War of Will can run that fast, but in the he hasn't been consistent. You never know when he's going to pop his best start. You know, on paper, you would think Tacitus and War of Will are the class in the race. Global Campaign's the horse you just don't know about right now. You don't know how good he is. He needs to improve on his Thoroughgraph numbers. Laughing Fox is a very, if the pace was fast, Laughing Fox actually is a really strong closer.
Mm-hmm.
He's overcome some severe speed bias races, and he's got a heck of a closing kick. Even in races on paper where it didn't look like he ran well, he ran a huge race in the Preakness. Yeah, he came from nowhere in that race. And, you know, he finished fifth, and he was beating 3¾ lengths, and he was flying at the end of that race. He was 10th at the eighth pole. You know, and we've seen what he can do. I mean, he ran some big races at, you know, early in the year at Oaklawn. You know, he came from way back. Again, also in the Arkansas Derby to finish fourth, and he won that that invitational race at Oaklawn. He came from way out of it for that race. I mean, it's a consistent closer. So, I mean, certainly can't forget him. And I'll even go one better. I'm not going to say he's going to win, but don't just totally eliminate. And people are going to totally eliminate Mijos in here. I wouldn't totally eliminate him either. I mean, he did beat Code of Honor in the Mucho Macho Man, and then you know, his race in the Holy Bull, he ran evenly in that race, and obviously something happened to him because he was out for 5 months. They brought him back in the Dwyer, and again he ran evenly to finish fourth to Code of Silver, who he had beaten earlier. But in that race, they went the last quarter in 23-3. So there was no way in the world. You know, he made a move up there, and he got a little tired at the end. But he's getting 6 pounds from War of Will, and he's getting 4 pounds from Tacitus. And like I said, he's beaten Code of Honor. He's coming off of two monster workouts. He worked 47-3 and then worked 6 furlongs and 113. It is Jimmy Jerkins who would not run him in here if he didn't think he had a shot. He could have easily run him in the Curlin Stakes and been one of the favorites in the race. So, look, I'm not saying he's good enough to beat these horses, but don't be surprised if Mijos is, you know, right there at the eighth pole and, you know, runs a pretty good race. I just think he needed that last race. You know, now I read Ortiz, you know, goes off of him to ride Tax, but, you know, he gets Junior Alvarado, and I don't think it really matters one way or the other. But I find it a very, very intriguing race. Any one of the horses in here can be right there.
It's a fun group.
Like anybody in particular in there?
I can only put them into, you know, three categories. I mean, Tacitus and War of Will have, just a little bit of a experience and level of competition edge. Global Campaign has got the upside. Tax, Laughing Fox, both are, you know, just a notch under those two. And like you say, Mijos is a horse that had shown, real potential, and you know, Jimmy is not a guy to put the spurs to a horse. He'll let them grow, and of course Don Little Jr. Centennial, there no pressure from them. All you have to do is look at Preservationist and what's gone on with him. So this is a very good competitive group of six. But right at the start of the show, I asked the exact same question, Steve, where the pace was going to come from, and the fact that you got Luis Saez, who loves sitting on a lead and is so good at it. It just feels like, you know, Global Campaign is going to be out there, and he can set whatever pace he wants to set.
You have to remember, too, by the way, is that when Global Campaign won the Peter Pan, he beat Sir Winston. So we know who he beat.
That's right.
You know, people are saying, oh, this drop is slow. He ran a mile and eighth in 146-3. Can't knock that.
No.
I don't care how fast the track might have been that day. You go 146-3 and you're running. So, you know, and he's trained by Stanley Huff, who to me is one of the best trainers, pound for pound trainers around.
Stanley, tonight, for those of you that are in town, 8:00 at the Parting Glass, one of Andy Serling's guests at the Post Live. Stanley, absolutely tearing it up. And in fact, he's got a horse. How about him? How about sending? He's got recruiting ready running in the Bing Crosby on Saturday.
Yeah, right. I saw that. Yeah, I mean, Bing Crosby looks like it's, back decent and, race. It's pretty
back and better than ever.
Pretty wide open race. There's interesting horses in there.
Steve, Steve, let me wrap it up because we're at an hour, and I've got Rich Eng, who we haven't talked to the last couple of weeks. Got to get Rich in here for an early summer visit.
I know. I don't like hogging Rich's time.
Well, I'm gonna every time we don't get to Rich, I'm just simply gonna lay it at your feet.
It's just my fault. I'll take full responsibility for Rich. I picture the person who's in the green room with the Tonight Show who always gets bumped and it always run out of time.
Exactly. Well, we will see you next week, correct? Or no, seeing you, where are you? Aren't you here?
No, we're leaving tomorrow.
Tomorrow, okay. All right, you're going to miss the thing tonight. I was going to have you join us at the fundraiser night with Shug and Allison and Easy Goer.
Oh. What is that anyway?
The Captain Gala, the CaptainCares.org, and now each day I've been counting down seats. I think as of this morning there were 2 seats left. So if you want to come, and we're not going to turn walk over, we won't turn away anybody that is a walk in cocktail attire. Please, 6 o'clock cocktail hour, 6 to 7, and then things get started at about 7 at the city center, and the unveiling of this painting of Easy Goer. Which is breathtaking, and Claude Ray and Allison on hand, and should be fun. Nick and Nick Zito and Kim as well, and much, much more.
By the way, speaking of Nick Zito, by the way, you think Mary Lou had something to do with Nick? You know, I mean, nobody's interviewed Nick, and nobody even knows he's around anymore. And then people all of a sudden start bringing him out. You know, you've had him on your shows, and he's on every show talking about Mary Lou, and he's back in the spotlight, and what does he do? And the horse that used to be the best horse in his barn, you know, comes back. I've got 30-1 and wins. So I don't know. Somewhere Mary Lou had something to do with that.
Well, so did dropping down in class. That had a lot to do with it.
Steve, I'm looking at this at a different level there.
Yeah, the best hop is the drop. Steve, I appreciate it, and we will see you this weekend, and looking forward to it.
Thank you, Steve.
Steve Haskin, folks, with his new phone, and he sounded great, and now he can let Joan out the back door of the house. I guess we're going to stay here and we're going to sprint to the finish. This has been a blur today. 3 hours went by in no time at all. Rich Eng is standing by. I wanted to catch up with Rich. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Steve.
Rich, dive right into it. What kind of a start are you off to at Del Mar? And I know you're playing plenty of Saratoga. Give us the early first week to 10-day view.
Well, I think the grades that I give to Del Mar management for the races they put on is an A. I mean, they've really worked hard to put a good product out there and a safe product, obviously. And, you know, I know on the weekdays they cut back to 7, like the 7 races like they are today, and they've been able to have more races on the weekends. And, you know, the quality of the races are good. I really think Del Mar's done a nice job. It's been fair racing, and if anything on the turf course, Steve, it really helps to have some speed. The turf course has been very firm. Speed's been holding up pretty well, and now they got the turf rail 30 feet out today. But I really have enjoyed the first couple of weeks.
I'm glad you mentioned the turf course and having to be a little bit closer than usual, because that is historically been a surface where the horse that moves last does the best. And, you know, DeSormo and Van Dyke and for years Nakatani, I mean, the way they rode that turf course, you know, you kind of slingshotted your way late. And, you know, in fact, that's what made Rosario's performance on Saturday with Mucho Unusual. That's what made it so impressive, because languishing, you know, far back and must have been tons the best. I mean, just gets up, but indeed you've had to be closer than usual. So that is something to watch, you know, as we go forward here, if that's going to change much at all. How about the main track? What are you seeing there, and who are you making money with?
Well, the main track's been very fair. And I tell you what, Flavion Pratt obviously is having a big meet. I picked him from day one as the most likely champion jockey of this meet. He's in all the big barns. He's getting a lot of live horses. And a jockey that actually has cashed a couple of nice tickets for me early in this meet is Rafael Bejarano. And he looks like a very, very hungry rider, Steve. You know, sometimes when you've been on the top of the mountain and you've been there a long time, you get used to it. And he's kind of had a little slippage in his business, but he sure looks like he's hungry to try to get it all back. So he's riding very aggressively out there, and I like that.
Saratoga, what have you been doing? You've been sharing action bi-coastal?
Yeah, I've been taking my pops. And in fact, I wrote an article for America's Best Racing a few days ago where, you know, I talked about main track only horses, which is something that, New York does quite often. And I think it's a very good angle for not only newcomers, but for, you know, for those of us who play the races all the time. Don't, when the races come off the grass at Saratoga, it's not a fold up your racing form in the past. You actually should look at those main track only horses. And the one example I used in my column was there was a race, I guess about 10 days ago, where a main track only horse paid like $30 in a seven horse field. I'm saying, you know, shame. You cannot let those kind of opportunities pass by.
Well, and in fact, that was the Ron Paolucci, and the horse was so obvious, you know, coming off the turf that it was astounding. And I banged that drum too. It's one of the amazing portions of horse racing discussion these days on the internet. You know, the way in which people just have snap decisions and throw up their hands, you know, for a long time, when it comes to the wet track. Years ago, I was intimidated by wet track and off the turf, and I didn't know how to play it. And, you know, slowly but surely, I started to get better, you know, a better understanding. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you listen to Andy, you know, we point this out all the time. I mean, Andy Serling for years has explained to people, especially at Saratoga, where there can be dead money in the pools, that, you know, people end up betting the race sometimes as if it was still on the grass. And they're completely missing, you know, the not just the MTOs too, Rich, because there's plenty of horses that outfits are entering because, number one, if it stays on the grass, they might answer a question about their horse. They might be trying to find out about an aptitude. But they also may have looked at the forecast and known that if this thing comes off, we've got even a better shot. So the way in which people just say, oh, I can't play. Oh, today's a washout. It's ruined. I guess go ahead. I mean, if that's your attitude, I don't really understand why are you even playing. Why do you pretend that you're interested in the game and making money? Because there's money making opportunities every single time under that scenario.
You know, I couldn't agree with you more, Stephen. You know, a word that I've heard used by you know, people is when you handicap horse racing, it's almost like you attack it with a toolkit, and you have a lot of tools at your disposal, a lot of angles you try to utilize. And, you know, I really like this angle that we're talking about with races that come off the turf, because I really think that, believe it or not, I actually think sometimes people are a little bit on the lazy side, and they bet a race, as you said earlier, as if the race was still on the grass, and they don't take into account the changes. And also, you know, with main track only horses, a lot of times you'll get entries as high as, you know, number 14, 15, 16. And a lot of people ignore the outside horses, even if they are main track only horses. So a lot of times it's just not using all the tools at your disposal to try to find winners. And, you know, even though a draw 16 and you scratch 8 of them that are grass horses, you know, you still got plenty of meat on the bone and a chance to make some money.
No doubt. You talk about the horses that are 15, 16. Occasionally, they're on the next page. And that's the worst feeling there is when you realize after a race that some horse, like a 15 or a 16, and you realize, oh, my God, there's another page. And somehow I didn't turn to the next page. And there was that, you know, there was that widow on the last page that you never saw.
I have done that before.
Of course, everybody has. Everybody has. And if you're saying never happened to me, you're a liar.
Yeah, there's a lot of ways to win, but there's also many, many ways to lose, and that's one
exactly
of them.
Exactly right. Exactly right. Looking ahead to today, you got maybe a play or two today, Rich, to discuss.
Well, yeah, off of my sheet, that I put out every day, I have races obviously at the Southern California track, which is Del Mar now, and I have the simulcast play. I'll do the simulcast play first because it's at Saratoga. I've been focusing on that. In race number four, I went for the number three horse Bailout. I know the price isn't too great, 5-2, but to me looks like a most likely type of winner, Bailout. So that's the number three in race number four. And then as far as at Del Mar today, let's go to race number four at Del Mar. It's 5 furlongs on the grass, and an angle that I've been using out of the toolkit to cash a lot of tickets is the ship and win angle. And it's very, very effective for not only helping to fill races out here in Southern California and recruit more horses to ship out from around the country, but also, I think the connections, the trainers and owners of these ship and win horses know that that boost in the purse really makes it a very, very attractive situation, paying and defraying the cost of shipping out there. And if they keep the horse out there, then it's a home run for Del Mar and for the California tracks to get these eastern influences. Race number four, I'm going to go with a two-horse stylishly. This horse had been trained by Sherry DeVoe back east, and this is a turf sprint. Simon Callahan is the listed trainer for this filly. But I think with Drayden Van Dyke up, this horse is going to be awful dangerous. Probably he'll be sitting off maybe the Baffert horse, the one Raneem, who probably is the most likely speed of the race. And stylishly probably be sitting second or third right off of that one. So I like the two-horse stylishly in race number four at Del Mar today, Steve.
Well, and you mentioned that horse that Arnold Zetcher, it's a homebred of Zetcher's, and Cherie did have stylishly. And what a perfect opportunity to bring it from Kentucky. It was training at Keeneland, and bring stylishly back out to California. And it's funny that you went to that race, because as it happened, I did print this because it sort of caught my eye. Eight horse field because of the sprint configuration, and so that kind of limits your options. Stylishly does make a lot of sense. I brought this race up too because of Cellar Door, the very expensive 2-year-old in training sale purchase from 2 years ago. This is a 4-year-old debuter for Jeff Mullins, and the Cannon Thoroughbreds people have been patient trying to get Cellar Door to the races, and certainly after spending $525,000, they want to get something from her. At the very least, you want to get a horse like this a win for her broodmare prospects down the road. So you do have a question of that first-time starter. And the Mandela, we won't know for a while about scratches, but Mandela also has got a congrats filly that would be a first-time starter if, in fact, Tinney had some way of getting in. We also talked about Brian Corner yesterday with Road Rager, the quality road filly for Samantha Siegel as well. Some quality about her, and you got to figure at some point she wins. But no, I think you probably landed in the right frame. I just looking at first turf statistics because Raneem, the Baffert, as you mentioned on the rail, FedBiz actually getting some turf winners. 12% is actually, 12% with turf horses and 12% first time turf.
Yeah, and Bob Baffert kind of put one over on us yesterday. He in race number four yesterday, yep. He had two horses in, and he won the race with a horse that hadn't run in 2 years and paid $20+ going wire to wire. And Hot Sean, the other Baffert, ran a good second, so it was a Baffert exact and a big one. You know, one point I wanted to bring up is interesting. You pointed out the Jeff Mullins first-time starter, the number six Celador, a four-year-old filly, first-time starter. But in the first race today at Del Mar, he also has another four-year-old first-time starter, the five Satanta. And you know, I'm trying to figure out whether I should look at a four-year-old first-time starter as a positive or a negative, because obviously that means Jeff Mullins was unable to get these two horses to the races at age two, at age three, but now at age four they're making their debut. I mean, do you view that as a negative or a positive, or how do you look at that, Steve? I'm going to ask you.
It's hard. I mean, generally older maidens like this, you know, they're kind of doomed a little bit, you know, in terms of their career prospects. But you know, whether they're homebreds or whether they're an expensive purchase, like you know, like Celador was, especially for fillies, you do want to get them a win. And in some cases, you'll see horses like this, if they can't win on the A circuit, they very quickly will. You know, find their way to a B circuit, and just to get a win, especially at the end of the year, whether it's a late season 3 year old or a 4 year old, even a 5 year old, and the owners want to either put them in a sale or maybe, you know, maybe cover them and you know, sell them down the road once they're in foal. But you need to get horses like this a win.
Yeah, you know, that makes perfect sense. You're right about the possibility of a filly or a mare when they go to the breeding shed. You want at least something on the resume, if not black type, at least a W and a maiden special, yeah, or something like that.
Exactly. So you know, and I'm just trying to get my hands on my because I hadn't really looked at California, but I wanted to see what might be what Andy Harrington's thoughts are. You know, these are horses that you then want to, you know, get a glance at how they've been working. And that's really the only way you're going to tell. And here's a quick some speed, inclined to see a stronger late kick on Satanta. And when it comes to Celador, seems down the line, more needed by now. Not exactly glowing endorsements from Andy Harrington. So I don't know if today's the day for the Mullins firsters.
Well, Andy's really good, so if he says the horse hasn't been working fast, then that's something to take into account for sure.
Rich Eng, everybody, and as Rich mentioned, the monthly piece at America's Best Racing and at RaceDayLasVegas.com. Rich Eng has daily analysis available for Del Mar and simulcast play, and you follow Rich Eng for Pro Pick on your Twitter machine, and his picks also featured spotlight picks on big days at BrizNet. Rich, I appreciate it, and we'll start to check in toward the big weekends that are going to be coming fast and furious as the summer unwinds.
Well, Steve, I appreciate you reaching out to me in the bullpen, and I'm always ready. The right-hander is always ready out here in Las Vegas.
just like Joe Nuxall, the old left-hander. Round in third and heading for home. We're doing the same. We're going to round third, head for the racetrack, because 12:45 first post for the AP Smithwick. Looking forward to that, and I want to wish Benji Hernandez and Carlisle Bell a safe trip today in the third. See if she can't stretch out in that spot, going nine. Brian Lynch looks tough on the front end, boy. Lynchy! I want to thank Bill Gallo and Michael Mulligan. That was fun and informative, his Breeze product. And Tony Black, Steve Haskin, Rich Eng, Joe on the board as well. Back with you for weekend preview tomorrow. HRRN coverage here on SiriusXM this afternoon, 3 to 7. Good luck today, everybody. Talk to you in the morning. Like sheep of the angels riding down the line. We think there is a soul. We don't know. That's
Go killing all the bees.